This week's parsha is Emor. Our parsha begins with mitzvot of the Kohanim. We know that Aaron's descendants were given special holiness. They're called Kohanim, what is translated sometimes as priests. I don't think that's an accurate translation. Servants of Hashem would be more accurate.
So, used also Kohanei Abar.
Correct. Designated personnel. So the Kohanim are supposed to be holy, and we will discuss what that means. They are limited in who they may marry. This is really challenging for a Kohen who is Chozer B'Tshuva. We will see why. A Kohen basically has to marry a virgin, and he can marry a widow, assuming that she kept herself pure and only had her husband very often. A Chozer B'Tshuva is going to marry a Chozeret B'Tshuva. He has a history, she has a history, and that disqualifies her from marrying a Kohen. Any woman that had an inappropriate relationship, if she was once intimate with a non-Jew, she can no longer marry a Kohen. If she is a divorcee, she can no longer marry a Kohen. So for a Kohen who's a Chozer B'Tshuva, this can be challenging. A Kohen who gets divorced has a challenge, because very often divorced men will marry divorced women. Well, a Kohen cannot marry a divorced woman. Even if it's his own divorcee, he cannot remarry her. That's why when a Kohen is going to divorce his wife, the rabbis make the procedure a little bit longer. They want him to reconsider. There's no reconciliation after they get divorced. A Kohen cannot say, well, I'll forgo my Kohen status and I'll marry this girl. I love her. I'll give up my kahuna for her. Doesn't work that way. Every day he's married to her. Every time he's intimate with her, he's transgressing. It's not like he lost his kahuna just because he did that. It's as though the halacha keeps standing over him and saying, you should really get divorced. You're doing something wrong. Every day you're married to her. So the kahuna comes with it a certain standard that the halacha demands of a kohen. The rest of Israel has a mitzvah to honor a kohen. The Torah says, "Vikidashto, sanctify him," meaning we give him first rights. When we read in the Torah, when we're going to bench, people sometimes do this. They get to benching and they say, "You bench, okay?" And then you're about to start benching. Is there a kohen in the room? Oh, good. So I'll say Birshus kohen. Wait, did you ask his permission? What does that mean, Birshus Kohen? Birshus Kohen means I have the permission of the Kohen because he has first rights. The way it should go is you ask, is there a Kohen in the room? And if there is, then you say, Mr. Kohen, you have first rights to benching. Are you willing to forgo them so that I can honor Mr. Ben Chamu? He could say yes. He could say no. It's his right. Technically, according to some opinions, you should also honor a Levi first. So even though the Levi doesn't have this mitzvah, but there are opinions that you should give first rights to the Levi. Are there any Levim here? No Levim here. Okay, so we have it easy. Torah tells us that the Kohen Gadol has more limitations. The Kohen Gadol can't even marry a widow. He has to marry a young girl, a virgin. The Kohen is limited. A Kohen may not go into a cemetery. A Kohen is not allowed to come in contact with a dead body or be in the same room as a dead body. So at last night's funeral, one of the cousins was married to a Kohen. Two cousins were married to Kohanim. So inside the funeral parlor, I guess they call that in English, the Beit Esped, where we gave the eulogies, while there was the deceased was there with us. So the Kohanim stood outside. They couldn't enter the same overhang, the same ceiling as the dead body. The Torah tells us that the Tumah spreads within the same building, within the same overhead. And tonight, that one of the Kohanim was there when I went to be Menachem Avo, my uncle. So my uncle asked him, how did you accompany the Levaya? How could you go down that block within the cemetery? So he told us something which I didn't know. He said that throughout Israel, all cemeteries do not have trees. You could go down any street in a cemetery, he said, I don't know if he said what he said is true, but he claimed that in Israel, being that we know that any overhang spreads the tumah under the overhang, so if you had a tree that gave shade, that was over a grave and also over the street, so if a kohen would go down that street, then the kohen would technically be sharing the airspace with a grave, and that's asur, that's biblically prohibited. So they're careful that all the streets that run through the cemeteries don't have any overhangs. They straight over them, they don't have to worry about trees. When I was growing up in Muncie, it was well known that driving down the street next to the cemetery, there were streets that went over there were trees that went over the street and over the cemetery. It's slightly problematic. A Kohen Gadol does not accompany the funeral even of his parents. A regular Kohen does, and from here we learn many halachot. The Torah says a regular Kohen goes to the funeral of father, mother, sister, who's not yet married, brother, son, daughter, wife. How many relatives was that?
Seven.
Father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, wife. From here we learn the laws of Avelis. That who must a person sit shiva for? Who must the person mourn over their passing? Those seven relatives. Father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, wife. A regular Kohen also has to become tameh for those relatives. He has to partake of their funeral. There was once a Kohen who did not want to. He said, they'll manage without me. And his brothers, the other Kohanim, pushed him and they said, you can't get away with it. And he said, Pesach's coming. If I go to that funeral, I won't be able to be a part of the Pesach offering. And they said, no one asked you. The Torah says you have to. You're going to go and take care of your sister in the funeral. And his brothers, the other Kohanim, forced him. The Torah tells us, okay, I see we're going slow, so I might as well give a few more details before we move on. Usually I do an overview of the parasha and then go in depth. Tonight I started going in depth, so we'll keep going in depth. So we have a few mitzvot when it comes to Kohanim becoming defiled. Number one, we have a unique aspect to this mitzvah, that the Torah gives us a directive, watch your kids. The male children should also not become tameh. So that means if you have a two-year-old son, and there's a funeral, and you're a Kohen, your wife, even if she's the daughter of a Kohen, she can go. But she can't take the baby with her. She has a nursing baby. She can't take the baby with her. We are commanded, unusually here, to watch our male children. The Kohen male children should not become tameh. So, this is one of the reasons that Kohanim prefer certain hospitals for their wife to give birth in. Because there are certain hospitals where you don't generally have people dying. You go to certain hospitals and they have a lot of wards in the same as the maternity ward. Other hospitals have a complete separate maternity section. It's its own building. And then they don't have to worry if they have a male son. They don't have to worry that the baby is in a building with a dead person. Even if they were in another hospital, you can't take a baby away from his nursing mother. But ideally, you prefer not to be in that situation. I have friends who are Kohanim. When their wife gave birth, they couldn't be with her. Because in Shaarei Tzedek, when someone passes away in the hospital, they have a sign outside the hospital that says, Azara LaKohanim, warning to Kohanim. They don't want to put out a sign that says, dead body in building. You wouldn't want to walk into a hospital like that. So they say it nicely. They say a warning to Kohanim. You could have a situation where the woman's giving birth and her husband can't be there with her. So that's why many Kohanim prefer hospitals where you don't run into that problem. Kohanim have to choose their airlines carefully. Lufthansa doesn't fly bodies. El Al does. El Al takes corpses on their planes when they fly into Israel. There are people who want to be buried here. So then a Kohen could run into a problem. There are ways to overcome the problem. I'm not aware if El Al sets it up in a way that the Kohen overcomes the problem. I'm unaware of... technically, we say Tumah shoots up and continues until it has some kind of ceiling over it. You could set it up in a way that the Tumah doesn't penetrate up to the plane. I am unaware of that being done.
What do you do, though?
They put it in the cargo.
They put it in a casket.
They put it in a casket in a box. It looks like a piece of cargo. Last night, they brought in... Does not have tzamit p'til. It is not of earthenware, it's not tzamit p'til, and it doesn't say that tzamit p'til protects from a body. It says tzamit p'til protects what's in it from outside tumah. I'm not aware of that being the case. And tzamit p'til only works when the kli is tahor. And over here the kli would become tamei. So I don't see how that would work. There are other ways to do it. You could have a tefach by a tefach and then have another overhang. You could set up the coffin so that it's bigger, so that the tumah would end, so the coffin would constitute its own building. The coffin I saw last night did not have a tefach by a tefach, as far as I could see. The whole box was this high. Saying the whole box that the deceased was in doesn't... Now, at first glance, you saw a box come in like special delivery. It wasn't a nice sight to be seen. I said to my wife, don't take it so badly. My grandfather, not hers. I said to my wife, you see in the Gemara, they used to put the deceased in a sack and hang him over the donkey to carry him. You know, this is better than it used to be. The Talmud discusses, don't sit on the sack as you're taking it to be buried. Unless you have to run from bandits, so then sit on the sack, because it's in the deceased's interest that you make it out safely. So the Talmud discusses where you place the sack with the bones or the deceased. So today, it's not nice to see a casket come in a special delivery box, but it's better than it used to be. At any rate, coming back to... this is only when you fly a person in. When you don't fly a person in, so then they can bring him in a more respectable way, on a stretcher, and wrapped in a talis, it's much nicer. Okay, so we have this warning about minors. There's a discussion in halacha, what happens after an ultrasound. If a woman does an ultrasound and she finds out she's a kohenet, she finds out that she has a male kohen in her stomach, does she have to now be careful not to go into cemeteries? And the assumption is that she should. The whole idea, the Talmud says, why may a woman, a female kohen, or the wife of a kohen, that's the important thing, the wife of a kohen, why may she go into a cemetery? The Gemara says, we don't even know if that child is a male. So but once you know if the child is a male, so then you run into problems. So that's why kohanim will very often not find out if their wife is pregnant with a boy, because that way she doesn't have to worry. We generally avoid going to cemeteries, period. Jews don't like spending time in cemeteries. And for sure, our custom is that pregnant women don't go to cemeteries. We still try to minimize it. Okay, there are sometimes exceptions. Sometimes. From here we learn other halachot. We learn that parents have to be careful with their children. We do not direct children to do something prohibited. We don't ask children to turn on a light on Shabbat. We don't give children non-kosher food to eat. You don't say, oh, they're only kids, let me take them to McDonald's, let them enjoy. Doesn't work that way. Children also have to eat kosher. Parents are responsible that their kids should eat kosher. Even though the kid doesn't understand, you know, doesn't matter if he's 1.5 years old. We're responsible to ensure that our children keep Torah as best as possible. It says you're not even allowed to tell your children to play with non-kosher food, because they might come to eating it. Now, this includes not only non-kosher food, but also vermin. My kids play with all kinds of bugs. It's not so simple to stop them. Like, they have names for their bugs. So the halacha says you can only let them do that if you're sure they're not going to eat them. It's not only a hygienic thing, it's a halachic thing. They're not supposed to eat bugs. They don't kill them. No, my kids, there's this bug that they call them Uri Kaduri.
The roly-poly.
The roly-poly. So the kids love them. And then their little brother took him and wanted to see what happens when he bends him in two. You should have seen how they were crying. Like, so we told them that he's not dead. He's just tired after what he went through. So we got to let him rest. But Allah says you can only do that if you're sure they won't eat him. So that's part of our responsibility to make sure our kids eat kosher. The Torah says a Kohen has to be careful. He's not supposed to become defiled with a dead body if it's not his immediate relative. But the Torah gives us a stipulation. This is contingent on the dead body being be'amav, within society. If you're walking outside and you're going on a hike and you're the Kohen Gadol, and it's the day before Yom Kippur, and you needed some time to get your thoughts together, so you're walking out in the forest, there's no one around, and you see a dead body. Good question. Tosas and Nazir asked that. Good question. You see a dead body out there. Now you tell yourself, wait a second, I'm the Kohen Gadol. I'm supposed to be doing the services tomorrow on the high holy days. But if I leave it out in the forest, by the time I call someone, the lions and tigers and bears of mine might eat it. Torah says you better take care of that body. But you're the holiest Jew on the holiest day, and you're going to lose that opportunity for this tremendous mitzvah to service the Jewish people, says the Torah, deal with the body. And this becomes the source for the halacha of dignity. The halacha of how we have to show dignity to a body. Now, Tosfos makes it even better. Tosfos says, who's this guy lying on the street that no one knows who he is? We're talking a guy who walked into town 3 days ago, spent his time in the bars, and gave everyone the impression that he might be a criminal. We know he's Jewish, but he's not the best, the VIP of the Jewish people. He showed up to town with debts, drinking, exhibiting behavior that is not exemplary of how a Jew should behave. And then the Kohen Gadol sees him dead, maybe of an overdose, in the middle of the forest. And the halacha says, deal with him. The halacha says he's a human being. You owe him a respect to the point where that supersedes your great mitzvot of being the high priest on Yom Kippur. So this mitzvah of dealing with the body, what we call in halacha mit mitzvah, well, that's a mitzvah that teaches us the concept of kavod abriyot, how much we have to give respect to human dignity. And this has a halachic weight. That's why in halacha it says if one is in the bathroom on Shabbat and they don't have the stones that you would ordinarily prepare to use to cleanse oneself after finishing in the bathroom, so they're allowed to take muktzah stones. Even though ordinarily you're not supposed to take stones that weren't pre-designated. Yeah, but human dignity supersedes that. We have a concept of kavod abriyot, that human dignity carries a halachic weight. Story. There was once a young man who was engaged to a young lady. He was Jewish. He didn't know much about being Jewish. And she was not Jewish. And she said to him, hey, we're living together anyways. Before we go and get married, let's find out about our heritage. Let's find out what it means to be Jewish. He wasn't too interested. She enrolled in classes on Judaism. And she started becoming more and more interested. And she dragged him along. And as she dragged him along, slowly but surely, she got him interested in Judaism as well. And as time went on, they learned more and more until he was Chozer B'Tshuva and she converted to Judaism. And they both became very pious people. And of course, once he was Chozer B'Tshuva, so they wanted to get married. So now they lived a life of purity. And they said, okay, we will get married. So they set a date. They were already not so young. They weren't youngsters in their teens. They were older. And he was learning in New York. And they told him there's this custom that before you get married, you should go to your father's grave and bring a wedding invitation. So a week or two before the wedding, he got into his car, and he drove out to the cemetery where his father was buried, and he brought a wedding invitation to his father's grave. As he was standing there, some moving moment, he looked at the grave, and he noticed on his father's grave, there was an engraving of two hands like this. So he came back to yeshiva, and he said, "Guys, what's that engraving of two hands on my father's grave?" So they said, "Well, the custom is that when a person's a kohen, they put that engraving on their tombstone." So he said, "Oh." So then someone said to him, "If you're a kohen, you're not allowed to marry a convert." So he went to Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, otherwise known as YU. And Rav Soloveitchik looked into the question, and he said, "This is sufficient proof that your father is a Kohen, and you may not marry this girl." So this couple, a short time before their wedding, were now told by the rabbi that they cannot get married. He is a Kohen, and he cannot marry her. And they sat down, and in their tremendous piety, they broke up, and they each married ultimately someone else and built beautiful homes in the Jewish people. Two tremendous Jews. Now I want to tell you another fascinating story. This story took place approximately 13 years ago. Maybe a little less, maybe 11 years ago. I was new here at Machon Meir. That's why I think it was probably about 11, 12 years ago. And we had just moved. We were living right there, across from Merkaz Arav. And we had just moved into our new house, a new apartment. And a student knocks on the door. I was in the process of building a bookcase out of planks of wood that I had collected that people threw out from closets they had thrown out. And in between each plank of wood, I put a cinder block. Okay, so I'm carrying these cinder blocks and building. And he asks if he could ask a question. And I say, "If you don't mind that I'm building the bookcase as we speak, you can ask." So he says to me, "I've been in your class for the last month, I know, and I'm engaged to a girl." I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, I'm converting to Judaism." I said, "Yeah, I know." He said, "I'm finishing the conversion now, in the next week." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, this girl and I, we both were not observant for the last 2-3 years. And we lived together in college. And now we have a date in 2 months to get married." I said, "Yeah." He said, "But now I just learned the halacha that says that if a non-Jew lived with a Jewish woman, when he converts, he's not supposed to marry her." So I stopped, and I'm holding a cinder block, and I started shaking. And I was like looking down at my toes, wondering if I'm about to lose them, because I wasn't sure I could continue holding the cinder block. And I'm standing there holding the cinder block, and I said to him, and he says to me, "Well, I also know the halacha says that if I already marry her, then I don't have to divorce her." And I'm standing there trying to hold on to the cinder block. And he says to me, "I asked the rabbi, and he said to me, don't ask so many questions, get married." And I'm standing there trying real hard to hold on to that cinder block. And I asked him, "Well, if the halacha is you're not supposed to marry her, but technically if you do, you don't have to get divorced, will you marry her?" And he looks at me as though I asked him the stupidest question in the world. And he says, "Rabbi, what's your question?" No, at that point, I slowly put down the cinder block. I realized I could not continue building the bookcase. It gave me a lesson in Yiras Shamayim, what it means to be a God-fearing person. So the conclusion was that for them it was permissible to get married. Without going into all the details, I called Rabbi Feinstein on this question, and given their details, it was lechatchila permissible for them to get married, and they did. In fact, they did. But this is an extension of what we learn in this week's parsha. The Torah does give us certain limitations as to whom a person is allowed to marry. Another thing that people don't know, just one second, is that a Kohen cannot marry a woman whose father is not Jewish. And this is again very common in Russia. Many of the Russian women have a mother who's Jewish, who married a non-Jewish person. So this woman is Jewish, and she's a very fine person. She did nothing wrong. But the halacha says one of the limitations of a Kohen is that he may not marry a woman whose father is not Jewish. This also puts a very big strain on Chozrim B'Tshuva from Russia. Because in Russia, in Ukraine, even the Jewish people, I'm saying many, many of the Jewish people have a mother who's Jewish and a father who's not Jewish, unfortunately, but that's the case. So that precludes their ability to marry a Kohen. Yes? If he converted before the mother conceived, that's fine. There's no problem. I just want to conclude this subject with a point that's very relevant to all of us. Our probably biggest danger as a people, as the Jewish people today, is intermarriage. Probably the greatest threat to the Jewish people today is not Iran. It is intermarriage. We are losing. We're losing so many people each year. The intermarriage rate is stunning. It is one very, very good reason to make Aliyah. Rav Goldberg, those of you who remember him, he used to teach here. Rav Goldberg always used to say, make Aliyah not only for the mitzvah of living in Israel, make Aliyah so your grandchildren will be Jewish, because the odds are stacked against you in Chutz La'aretz. And you have to know that even if you lead a very observant lifestyle and you send your kids to Orthodox schools, it's still a challenge. The intermarriage rate, even among the Orthodox, is stunning. So this is a point to be aware of. A, in choosing our own environment, make sure to be in an environment where you'll meet a nice Jewish girl. If it's the college you're choosing, if it's the place you're choosing to do your internship, a person has to be wary of who he's going to rub shoulders with. The environment we choose will very often define who we end up marrying. When we ended high school, Mr. Frankel, our high school principal, used to tell us, choose a college with Jewish girls. Now, we went to a very observant high school. We never heard the word girls in school. They never spoke to us about girls. It just wasn't discussed. And when he said it to us, we were shocked. But he was so right. Choose a college where there are Jewish girls. That's very, very important. It has to be a prime factor in the college we're choosing. Not only the education we're getting, we have to think about our long-term future. This is also relevant to our children. Sometimes parents feel like there's nothing wrong if their daughter works as a checkout clerk in Rami Levi or any of the supermarkets. Well, if the bagger is an Arab, then you should be aware that the most observant girls have also been lured by the guy standing behind her every day complimenting her and then just inviting her for a drink or just bringing her a gift, and slowly their relationships have evolved. This is true of even the holy Givat Shaul down the block, where unfortunate things have happened. So a person has to be aware. Your daughters, your children, make sure they are in an environment that they will not be lured to marrying someone not Jewish. This is the greatest danger the Jewish people face today, and parents are sometimes too innocent about it. There is a day camp program that will take your kids at no cost to Europe, but you have to be aware it is fully funded by Christian organizations. And there is an underlying theme that they are trying to give children. So when you're offered this free program for your children to multiculturally travel to Europe, you have to find out what's going on there. Who are they going to be in contact with? We're moving forward in our parsha. Torah gives us a special warning for Kohanim not to shave their beards with razors. We know Jews are not allowed to shave their beards with razors. The question is, how do we understand this unique commandment for Kohanim? Why is it relevant to us? Because a Kohen who transgresses the mitzvot that are unique to the sanctity of Kohanim may not go up to the Duchen. So I had a friend whose father had married, he was a Kohen and his father was a Kohen. But his father had married someone that a Kohen is prohibited from marrying. So the child could not go up to do Birkat Kohanim. He could not get in Aliyah as Kohen because he was a Chalal. A Chalal is a desecrated Kohen. His father had desecrated him. That's it. He lost that aspect of sanctity of Kahuna because his father had married a woman he was prohibited to marry. And then his brother decided, I want the Aliyah of Kohen. I want to go up to Duchen. And he put a tremendous strain on the rabbi of that community. What are you supposed to tell the guy? You know, I'm sorry, you're disqualified. Now the story is worse because his brother had wanted to marry a divorcee. And his brother went and proved that the father had married someone illegitimate and that he was no longer a legitimate Kohen. Meaning ordinarily you could say, I don't know all the facts of the story, so I don't have to fight him when he wants to do it. But his brother had wanted to legitimately marry a divorcee. So in order to do that, he had gone out of his way to prove that he was already a disqualified Kohen, that he was a Chalal. After it was proven, the younger brother came and said, I want to go up as a Kohen. Well, your brother just proved you're a disqualified Kohen. What am I supposed to do? These are sad realities of the holiness that Kohanim have and they have to maintain. What happens when a Kohen uses a razor to shave himself? Can he continue going up to the Duchen? Do I say he's doing his own personal transgression? What does it have to do with me? Or do I say that when the Torah reiterated the commandment not to shave with the razor, the Torah was making it part of the sanctity of the Kohen? Different than me and you not shaving with a razor. Two opinions in halacha. That's a machloket in halacha. The Torah then goes on to tell us that different blemishes disqualify a Kohen from serving in the Beit HaMikdash. The idea here is not that there's something wrong with a blemished Kohen. He might be the most pious person. The Talmud tells us one of the greatest sages, Rabbi Yoshua, was one of the most ugly people that ever lived. It wasn't pleasant to look at him. The emperor's daughter saw him and said, what an ugly person, right? A person can be a great sage, he can be a phenomenally kind and good person, and we have no controls over how we look or what blemishes God or life has placed upon a person. And nonetheless, the Torah says this person cannot be our representative in the temple. And the idea behind it, it seems, is that there are two approaches you can take to the Kohanim. You could say, I'll take the people who can't be successful in anything else in life and let them be the Kohanim. Or you could say, I'll take my best candidates and they will be the Kohanim. It's like the U.S. military. Sometimes in the U.S. military, they're going to take all those people who might be criminals and they say, let's give them an education, let's send them out to the army, though. You know, they'll make something good of themselves. And then you have people who are the utmost citizens, and they see an honor of being a part of the military. There are two types of people that join the military. The same idea. The Torah did not want us to view the service of the Beit HaMikdash as something that you give your worst candidates to. And so the Torah wanted that when we come to the Beit HaMikdash, we will recognize that this is something tremendous. And it's a merit, it's a zchut to be up there. The finest citizens are those that are up there. So that's why the Torah says, even though technically there's nothing wrong with the guy who's blemished, but the impression it'll give the people who have come to the temple is wrong, and that's why the Torah tells us you may not allow a person who's missing a nose to be your Kohen. He cannot serve in the temple. If the Kohen has different blemishes that are visible externally, different blemishes that will make it so, and the Torah gives us a whole listing, they cannot go up there. He's missing an arm. You know, if you walked into the temple and you started feeling that different people with different handicaps, they're the Kohanim, so then you might walk away feeling like, okay, the service of Hashem is it's a factory where you let people who can't do anything better with their lives, you let them work there. No, it's the greatest merit, and you'll only give people who are fine and choose to do it out of an appreciation of the greatness. Yes. There are different spots in the eyes. The Torah is describing one type of person doesn't have a bridge of his nose, so his face looks funny. Another type of person has the white of his eye mixing with the black, or the black mixing with the white. There are different blemishes the Torah is talking about. The Torah discusses many blemishes. Meaning there's... Yeah?
What about the Kohanim which have a problem with speaking, less stuttering or lisping or something like that?
Not aware of that being disqualifying. The Torah describes that if someone touches something defiled, they can't walk into the Beit HaMikdash. The Torah describes how the daughter of a Kohen may eat from the holy foods of the Kohen until she marries. Then she becomes a part of that family. If her husband's a Kohen, she could eat from the holy foods. What happens when her husband dies? So if there are children or grandchildren around, she's considered still connected to her husband's family. If there are no children or grandchildren, then she goes back to her father's home and she can again eat from his holy foods. We're moving forward. The Torah tells us when we bring a sacrifice, it has to be lirtzonchem, of our own volition. You can't force a person to bring a sacrifice. It always has to be of his volition. What happens when a person says, I promise to bring a chatas this year, and then the courts know he won't do it? So then the courts threaten him to the point where he will do it. Wait a second, that's called of his own volition? So the assumption is that everyone has goodwill. You sometimes have to help a person reveal that goodwill, but everyone has goodwill. It sounds like a funny concept. It happens to be a phenomenal concept. Very often, a person who is honest with himself knows that there are dark sides to his personality. Every person has dark sides to their personality. Every one of us should really say a special blessing, thanking God that our thoughts aren't printed on our foreheads. It would be a sad state of affairs. We maintain a certain dignity in society because no one knows what anyone else is thinking. And we can all connect to the concepts that we believe are right. And we can try to ignore the dark sides of our personality, overcome them, control them, and be fine, upstanding citizens. But they're definitely there. God created us with a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Hara. There is a component of the human being that can be very evil, cruel, self-centered, defiled, deranged, and the list can go on, right? So when the Torah tells me that when the courts threaten a person and then he will bring the sacrifice, what the courts are really doing is they're revealing the true you, the Torah is reminding us what is the true me. Very often in life, people can convince us People can speak badly of us. Sometimes it's someone who we value. It could be a spouse, it could be a parent, it could be an educator, it could be a teacher, it could be a rabbi. You suddenly hear they said something negative about you, and it challenges your own self-worth. You suddenly ask yourself, wait a second, am I that? If that's what they think of me, well, am I that? The Torah says you're good. Every human being is good. The Torah, in giving us this mitzvah, is telling us you should know your identity is positive. You are a good person. Sometimes you get confused. Sometimes you get taken by your weaknesses. Sometimes you need someone to threaten you in order to get you back on track. But at your core, what do you really want to do? Your true identity is positive. So this mitzvah reveals to us the Torah's philosophical approach, or the Torah's revealing to us what we're really made of. And this is a point to always hold in our consciousness. No one can change who I really am. I am a positive person. Have I done things that are wrong? Unfortunately, I have. Have I done things I regret? Unfortunately, I have. Is that my identity? No. My identity is positive. The Torah reiterates the same concept as we said with regards to Kohanim, the same concept with regards to the animals. You cannot bring an animal as a sacrifice that's blemished. Imagine, let's take an example. I walked into a shul once. I didn't have a talis. I said, do you guys have extra talis? And they said, sure, in the back corner. I said, what's in the back corner? They said, everyone whose talis is destroyed, they just throw it in the back corner. So you have a pile of talis in there. You can take one from there. I start picking up the talis. Oh, boy. That's the thing. You donate the shul, your talis that's all worn out, that's all finished. Imagine if you came to the temple and what you see, you see animals limping up, this animal's missing a leg, that animal's missing an eye, the next animal's missing a tail. It's an attitude. What do I donate? What do I designate? Torah says you can't bring a sacrifice of an animal that's blemished. Again, it's an attitude. The Torah tells us we're allowed to accept sacrifices from non-Jews. But again, we insist that the animal look fine. From a Jew, we have a higher level of stringency than a non-Jew. By a Jew, we say even small blemishes disqualify the animal. By a non-Jew, we say it has to be a bigger blemish, something that's obvious. A small scratch. There are smaller things where a Jew wouldn't have to worry about it, and a non-would have to worry about it, and a non-Jew would not. Yes?
Halachically, today, could a non-Jew bring a sacrifice to God?
I don't know. Research it, tell me what the answer is. I don't know. I don't. Oh, it's a good start. Torah tells us when we sacrifice an animal, you have to give the animal 7 days, and only on the 8th day can you sacrifice it. Beforehand, you may not bring the animal as a sacrifice. This is true of sacrifices. It's not true of the animals you eat personally. This is specifically for a korban. Yes?
No, just to help me. What's the name of the rabbi that like studies the Beit HaMikdash, a lot like all the halakhot about Beit HaMikdash, and gives here every year like a show about the Beit HaMikdash?
I don't know.
There's a rabbi when we have like a feast day, he comes here and does a presentation like each year about the Beit HaMikdash. I find out his name. This guy, he knows. He's like the expert, like the biggest expert on Beit HaMikdash. So he will know.
Torah says you're not allowed to sacrifice a mother and her child on the same day. Whether this applies to a father animal and its child is not clear. Ordinarily, people did not know who the father animal was. There are unique instances where you do know, and then ideally you should not slaughter them on the same day, says the Rambam. Rashi is of the opinion that halachically it only applies to the mother. Two opinions in the Talmud. Rashi goes with the opinion it only applies to the mother. Rambam is of the opinion that it's just a practical thing, that ordinarily you didn't know who the father animal was, right? Which animal this animal mated with. Because in a corral, how can you follow who...
No, I'm saying why shouldn't you sacrifice him?
The reasoning of the mitzvah seems to be a concept of to teach us a certain respect for the animal. that you're not killing the parent and the child on the same day. You're allowed to slaughter them, but don't be completely callous to the fact that you're slaughtering these animals. Meaning there's a certain sensitivity. The Torah says you're allowed to eat their meat, you're allowed to sacrifice them, but even as you do it, you shouldn't be completely callous to the idea that there is a life here that's leaving. There's some value, and so this teaches us a certain sensitivity about making things extinct, about the fact that we're entitled to use them, but there's a certain balanced approach. You could slaughter them day after day. Don't do it on the same day. It's a certain sensitivity the Torah wanted to develop within us, which again is a balanced sensitivity. I will still eat it. I will still use it. But I will tame myself. I won't do it to completely make this animal extinct. I will do it in a way that at least arouses within me a certain sensitivity as I do it. Okay, at the end of the parasha, the Torah goes through the different holidays. It begins with Shabbos and works its way through the holidays. The holidays are called Mikra'ei Kodesh. What does Mikra'ei Kodesh mean? Mikra'ei Kodesh means two things. One, it's a day of designated holiness. So we designate the day by making Kiddush. Kiddush many times is biblical. At the night when the holiday begins, you are saying, I'm designating this day as a holy day. So that's one interpretation of the word Mikra'ei Kodesh. There's another interpretation, says Ramban. And that is that we're supposed to unite as a family on the holiday. Mikra is the calling of a gathering. So a person is not supposed to spend his holidays in Dahab or in some hotel in Switzerland. You're supposed to be with family on the holiday. And you're supposed to daven with a minyan on the holiday. Ramban brings an opinion that on the holidays it's a biblical mitzvah. It's a mitzvah d'oraita to daven with a minyan. So on Shabbat, on holidays, it's family time. That's another concept of Mikra Kodesh. Parents will sometimes be asked by their children, I want to daven in the youth minyan. Children will sometimes say, I want to eat the Shabbos meal by my friend. Sudash Lishit is in Bnei Akiva, Ezra, or Ariel. Think about it a few times. You have to retain the family structure. Sometimes you gotta let your kids see other homes. It's important for them. Sometimes you gotta let your kids go away to events. There's a balance, but there has to be a basis. The basis is Shabbos, we're at home. My son once said, I want to go to the rabbi to eat the meal. The rabbi's son is my best friend. I want to eat the meal by him. I thought about it, and I said, no. I said, you want to eat with your friend? Why don't you invite him here? So the kid looks at me and says, his father would never let him leave their Shabbos table for the meal. I said, oh, thank you. Okay. I'm supposed to be the dunce, right? So again, there's a balance. Sometimes you're going to let them go, but the majority of the meals, the kid has to feel like they're part of the family. You're important to me. I once dated a girl, and she said to me the following line. She says, if a child misbehaves at the Shabbos table, I would tell the child at some point, you know, when they misbehave and they're overtired and they've gone too far, being a part of this family is a privilege. You can go to your room, and when you know how to behave, you could come back to the table. And then she asked me, what do you think of that? I said, I think that being a part of the family is a given. It's not a privilege. You're a part of the family. And if I have to send the child away from the table, then I want to express to the child that I'm sad that I'm sending them away from the table. And I can't wait for them to decide to behave properly because I want them at the Shabbos table. And when they're away from the Shabbos table, it's because I don't have a choice and I'm waiting for them to decide they'll behave. It could be we'll end the Shabbos meal and they won't come back to the table because they don't know how to behave. But what I want to express to them is that I want them at the table. They're part of the family. It's not a privilege. It's a given. It's part of what's important in a child's concept. But it's also what's supposed to be important for us. That means that we try to be home for Shabbos. I came home this past Thursday. I boarded a plane on Wednesday. I was learning with you guys on Thursday when my grandfather passed away. And when I came to the Shabbos table, my son asked me, Abba, do you think Saba died because you left him? I said, no, I don't think so. So he said to me, well, do you feel bad that you left him? And I said, no, I had to be with him for 10 days to help him get better, and I did what I could. But I had to be back home with you for Shabbos. I missed one Shabbos with you. I wasn't supposed to miss a second Shabbos. There's a certain amount you have to give, and I gave it. I knew I couldn't explain it to him that there was no natural way that he would live. That at the point where he was holding, it was a question of whether he'd live 1 day or 2 days or 3 days, and as much as I could have given him, I gave him. If I would have thought it would have made a difference, I would have had to stay another Shabbos. But the idea, children have to know, Shabbos is important. It's important that we're together. It's important that I'm with them. It's important that they're with me. And sometimes that means we can't have guests over. Sometimes having guests enriches the children. They learn to value it. They enjoy the guests. It's enriching. It's a mitzvah. It's a part of your home. Great. The main part of your home is your home. Mikra Kodesh, says the Ramban, it's a holy time to unite with family. The Shabbos table should be fun. Before we moved to Kochav Yaakov, we would never end the Shabbos meal in time for davening. We would end up davening Rabbeinu Tamar later, because you're eating Seudah Shlishit. Where are you running off to? Why should the meal end? Your kids are finally talking to you. You've had the whole Shabbos together. Where are you rushing to? Why do we have to make Havdalah on time? What happens if we make Havdalah an hour later? Before we moved to Kochav Yaakov, now I have to be there. I give class there. But before we moved there, our meal kept running. And then we'd go to Zupnik. We'd catch a late minion. The Torah recounts the holidays. We begin with Pesach. I recommend that you guys take time as you build your education. Take a Jewish calendar. Memorize the 12 Jewish months. Learn your birthday by heart. What's your Jewish birthday? Learn which holiday shows up in which month. You should try. I recommend from now on, write your checks. You're in Israel. Write the Jewish date. When you start writing notes, write on the top of the page the Jewish date. You want to start living the Jewish calendar. And that includes knowing which holiday is when. And so when we speak about Nisan, you should know right away. Okay, in Nisan was when we designated the Mishkan. In Nisan, we don't say Tachanun. And then on the 14th, we would bring the Paschal overing. And that the night before, we do Bdikas Chametz. The night of the 15th is when we have Pesach. Pesach lasts 7 days. Yes, in Chutzlarts, we have Yom Tov Sheni, an 8th day. We move on. We have Sfiras Omer, and on the 6th of Sivan, we have Shavuot. Shavuot lasts 1 day, but many people have the custom that for the 7 days following it, being that you could bring your Shavuot sacrifice for 7 days afterwards, so many shuls won't say Tachanun for 7 days after Shavuot. Nisan, Iyar. Okay, so in Iyar we have Hey Iyar, Yom Ha'atzma'ut, Chavchet Iyar, Yom Yerushalayim, in the middle of Iyar, Yudchet Iyar, Lag Ba'omer, and then Sivan Shavuot. Tammuz, on the 17th of Tammuz, was Shivasar Tammuz. 5 terrible things happened to the Jewish people. You guys can look up the last Mishnah in Tanis, second to last Mishnah in Tanis. Av, we have the 9th of Av. The 15th of Av is a holiday. Elul is the month that leads up to Tishrei, where we have Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot. Cheshvan has no holidays, Mar Cheshvan. And in Kislev we have Chanukah, the rabbinic holiday. Right? Kislev, Chanukah runs into Tevet. On the 10th of Tevet we have a fast day. And then we have on Shvat, the 15th of Shvat, which is the Rosh Hashanah for the trees. And then on Adar we have the rabbinic holiday of Purim on the 15th, 14th, and 15th of Adar, depending on what city you're in. Review it, write it down, take time to know it. It's one of the basic things you should know. Make sure you know your Jewish birthday. And I recommend you start working with a Jewish calendar and the Jewish date. Take advantage that you're living in a Jewish country and you could sign your checks with a Jewish date. It should become a part of our lives. We